Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? Welcome to the Around the World podcast. I'm your host, Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more in the Around the World podcast. For this episode of the podcast, I sat down to talk with Matt Sheehan. Matt is a really interesting guy. He's been living in China for 5 years, and in that time he has learned the language and picked up a job as a journalist at the Huffington Post, where he travels the country in search of interesting stories. He and I mainly talked about China. We started with the epic pollution levels in and around Beijing, and we got into the current state of the economy. We also talked about language learning in general, Matt's series of Ultimate Frisbee videos, and his recent walk across Beijing. Matt always has a number of projects in the works, and of course I greatly enjoyed talking with him, so let's get right to our discussion. Matt Sheehan,
hello.
Thanks for coming on. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to come out here and talk to me.
Happy to be here. Beautiful view.
Cool. Yeah, we're sitting here in my apartment in Beijing, China. We live on the 13th floor, and not too many buildings in this neighborhood go taller than ours, and there's a lot of little small short houses leading out to the west of us, and then there's a mountain range far to the west, and it's a low pollution day today in January, and we've got a beautiful view. We're watching the sun go down right now. I'm really loving this place.
Yeah, this is one of the better views I've seen in Beijing. It's kind of, I always think of, if you're in this area and you can see the mountains in the west, yeah, that means it's a nice day in terms of pollution.
Definitely, yeah. I've noticed, I can tell the number, like how polluted it is with the PM2.5 count. Almost, I can get a pretty good guess of it just by seeing how far I can see.
Yeah.
And the first thing that goes is the mountains once it gets a little bit worse, and then goes a couple of the closer buildings. And on really bad days, it's like two blocks. I can barely see. But I was just at home recently in the States, and pretty much everyone I talked to, the first thing they brought up was this recent red alert with the pollution.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess I had heard a little bit about it here, but it's just kind of become part of my daily life living in China. Mm-hmm. But everyone seems to know about it internationally. So I was hoping we'd talk a little bit about that. You've done a lot of writing about pollution in Beijing, right?
Yeah, the red alert was kind of a funny thing because it made a bunch of international headlines. Beijing issues red alert for pollution. So everyone thinks, oh, that means the pollution must be worse than it's been before. This must be like a new, you know, terrible, smoggy, high point. But it's actually, the red alert is actually a good sign in a lot of ways. The pollution wasn't actually extremely high on those days, but it was the first time the government was proactively warning people and taking these kind of emergency measures. So it means cutting down on the number of cars that are on the road by limiting, it's based on what is the last number in your license plate. So they sort of kick half the cars off the road, close down schools, close down factories. So the red alert is, you know, we kind of wish that there were red alerts 3 years ago when it was actually truly at epic, epic heights. And we have had some of those days recently. But in a lot of ways, the red alert was kind of a red herring in that it's actually a sign that the government is taking this more seriously and sort of being more transparent about it, about how bad it is, as opposed to it actually getting worse.
Sure. Do you want to just give people an idea of the actual numbers we're talking about? Because It's so abstract if you've never been to China, like what kind of numbers you're dealing with or what do you even use to measure pollution?
Yeah, so they're using the concentration of PM2.5 particles, and they're basing it on how many particles are in a square meter. PM2.5 is a measurement of the width of the particle, I guess. And
Yeah, isn't it like 2.5 microns? Is that it? Or nanometers?
I don't know the units. I just know that the 2.5 ones are the nasty little buggers that burrow deep into your lungs and do bad things to you. So there's other ones. There's PM10. That's like another measure of pollution. That's larger particulates. But they're actually less dangerous if they're larger because they get filtered out by your various sort of natural filters, like your nose hairs. Mm. Whereas the PM2.5 goes all the way in. And so that's generally what people are paying attention to, and then it's sort of graphed onto an air quality index, AQI, which traditionally the scale goes 0 to 500, and just to like vague numbers. In China, in Beijing here, I usually use 300 as like the marker between like when it's terrible and when it's less terrible.
So above 300 it's terrible?
Yeah, in the US it would be more like above 100 would be like, whoa, like what's going on here? I think the city with the worst pollution in I guess it was 2014, I think was it was actually like Bakersfield, California or something like that.
Oh, strange.
And that averaged I forget exactly what the number was, but you know, in Beijing last year the average was I think around 170, I believe.
Average
was 170, yeah, and that's just bad news.
Definitely. Yeah, once it gets 170, it's like you can't really see the blue sky anymore. It's you definitely have an obstructed view.
Yeah, the good thing is that things are actually getting better in this respect. They've been getting more and more attention, but that's partly obscuring the fact that on average these numbers are actually going down over time, which is partly based on the government actually going out there and cleaning up the dirtiest factories, more like shutting down the dirtiest factories and installing more scrubbers in the existing sort of, it's a lot of it is power plants, steel factories, cement factories, glass factories, sort of like the worst polluters. So it's benefiting from some government efforts in this area since about 2012, 2013, but it's even the ironic thing is it's benefiting from China's slowing economy. Basically, all these industries that are the most polluting industries have been in deep, deep trouble for the last 2 years or so. And that means that China's coal consumption has gone down because steel, cement are usually pointed out as the two biggest ones. And China had a huge glut in supply of these because for the last decade plus, it was just throwing steel and cement at highways, high-speed rails, new buildings, new roads. You know, this was the infrastructure boom of like 2000-something to 2014, especially in the post-financial crisis world, where China sort of stimulated its economy to get over that hump.
Okay. Yeah, they weren't really affected as badly as we were they?
In
2008.
They were affected by the fall in exports to the U.S. and the rest of the world, but they made up for a lot of that by just turning the spigots on at their state-run banks, saying, you know, lend money to whatever infrastructure projects are necessary. So that was good for the economy in that it powered them through that. But it created this huge glut in all these industries that feed into infrastructure, and that glut also ended up becoming the glut in the Beijing skies from coal consumption. So it's kind of the twisted thing is now that China's economy is doing worse and they're producing less of these things, the skies are clearing up sort of naturally in that respect. So
there's good and bad to it.
Yeah.
Well, we should talk a little bit about the economy too. I mean, that's kind of the other crazy thing that's always in the news with China. Anytime someone wants to know about China. What do you think about it? What's happening?
Well, it's another thing where there's kind of a red herring in the same way that sort of the red alert was a red herring, in that everyone looks at the Chinese stock market, and over the last year the stock market's been in the news a lot. But the Chinese stock market is actually very, very detached from the real economy here. It's very based on speculation, largely in the U.S. it's a lot of big like institutional investors with sort of actually deep understanding of the fundamentals of the company, and these companies' stock prices are not going to be shooting around wildly. But in China, it's the stock market only came about in the 90s, and it's still very, very immature. It's more like a casino. So for all the, you know, all the craziness that was in the stock market, it went way, way, way up for about 8 months straight, and then it started crashing circa June, July, and then it's happening again now. So that kind of distracts everyone, says, like China's falling apart. And that's not the case, But it also, kind of even more worrying, is that it distracts from like the actual fundamental problems. The Chinese economy does have a lot of fundamental problems, which is pretty much related to the pollution stuff that we were just talking about. It's this huge transition they're going through where the old sources of growth, aka cheap exports to the rest of the world, spending on infrastructure, spending on high-speed rail, and just like major heavy industry investment, those sources of growth are fading very, very, very quickly. And, you know, basically that part of the economy is kind of dying like a painful death. It's contracting. And the question is, can that productivity be made up in the service sector, in sort of private household consumption? So not pouring money into steel and cement factories, but ordinary people going out and buying, going traveling, buying household goods, buying more services, whether that's like educational services or, you know, financial services or, even simple services like haircuts and,
sure,
you know, pedicures.
Sure, and day-to-day life here seems, I don't see anyone freaking out in the streets or anything, and people are doing all these things that you're mentioning. I mean, I was just traveling around the country recently. I went from here to Hong Kong by train, and there's so many Chinese tourists everywhere you go. I mean, most of the tourists are from China. They're domestic, and
it's a very tricky thing. A lot of what the economy looks like to you now depends very much on your level of education and on your geographic location. So basically, China, just like the U.S., China has a rust belt, which is sort of the area surrounding Beijing in kind of a headlock. It's like Hebei province, Shandong province, the provinces in the northeast. And these are the areas that rely on heavy industry, the stuff that we're talking about. These are like, there's one city I went to last year reporting, a city called Tangshan, just about an hour and a half, 2 hours east of Beijing. That city produced more steel than the entire United States.
Holy crap.
For several years. So, I mean, like, that's Hebei province, which sort of surrounds Beijing on three sides. Yeah, it produces, I don't have the exact numbers right, but something along the lines of that province, you know, produces almost as much steel as the rest of the world combined. Like, this, you know, this scale of madness. So these areas, if you're a low-educated worker in these areas, you're kind of screwed. You know, you're not, the former steel worker is not going to become the, you know, travel guide. He might become an Uber driver, but generally speaking, he's kind of like shut out of this, you know, new economy. Everyone wants China to upgrade to a new, upgrading on the value chain,
into
a services economy. You know, it means less people are like hammering steel and more people are using their brains and their creativity. So, yeah, overall, that would be a great thing. But in this transition period, it's pretty painful for the people who are like, well, spent the last 30 years, you know, shoveling coal.
Sure.
And now you're telling me that this is not, like, the thing to be doing anymore. Yeah. But this guy is not immediately going to go and open his own, like, Taobao, you know, e-commerce store.
Right. Not going to happen. But what about his kids? Didn't you write something about this recently with... I forget exactly where, but a kid who his parents had very little education, and he overcame that to come to
Beijing. That was a story. It was about a coding boot camp. So one of these kind of like, you know, you go in for 3 months, pay a fee, and you're supposed to come out like an employable software programmer.
Oh, so it's like a school almost then.
Yeah, it's like a school. They have online versions. It's in the west of Beijing. And I chose that story topic because it is kind of an encapsulation of these economic transitions in the sense that, high tech is a very exciting industry in China. It's not a huge employer. It's not, you know, it's not going to employ like 100,000 grunt workers, you know, like the way the steel, or more than 100,000, millions of grunt workers, the way the steel industry does. But I went to one of these schools in the west of Beijing, and I profiled a couple of students there and the founder of it, where you can see in these one person's life, you can see the giant vault the Chinese economy made over the last 20 years and how difficult it's going to be to vault up to the next levels. Like, the last 20 years were about just going from a, you know, agricultural and heavy industry economy to more like a kind of agriculture, a lot of heavy industry, but a little bit of service, a little bit of, you know, lifestyle going in there. So the guy, his name was Wang Ruyi, I think. And he came from a really poor the province of Guizhou, which is the poorest province in China, and a really poor village in Guizhou province. So I remember him telling me that, like, the way that they would sort of distinguish, like, family, you know, class levels in his province, in his village, was like, do you own a water buffalo or not? Or, like, do you own two water buffaloes, you know?
So that would make you really rich.
Yeah, you're the man. You've got a whole team of water buffaloes. And, like, his dad went to school until third grade. His mom never went to a day of school in her life. And he, by virtue of being, he's very intelligent, very curious, and just his parents knew to, like, you know, drive him to get some education. He made it through college, made it out of college. He studied computer science in college, but Chinese university life, you don't really learn very much. It's just, it's kind of like once you get, high school is hell. Like, Chinese high school is way harder than our high schools.
Yeah.
But Chinese college is way easier than our
colleges. Yeah, it's almost the opposite of us.
Yeah.
Like, you start getting serious once you get to college and
it's total opposite. Kids are just, I liken it to kids. They're preparing, you know, all of middle school and high school is preparing you for Gaokao, the college entrance exam, a two-day test that determines your college admissions, like, 100%.
And yeah, so, we should, like, really emphasize that. That's it. That's right. That's all they look at. They don't care if you play the violin or something, right?
Like, yeah, it's 100% Gaokao.
You've got one test.
Unless you're, like, a, you know, a real, real athlete or something like that. You might get into a sports school.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's very, very high-stakes testing.
So much pressure must be on you to do well on that.
Yeah, I mean, you just see kids. I remember when my first year in Beijing, when I was at a Chinese university, I just look around and be like, why are there so many 19-year-old guys with gray hair?
Like, really?
With just like either, a lot of them will just have like a patch, or they'll just have gray hair like sprinkled throughout. I mean, I don't know. Okay, I can't say. Maybe, you know, maybe Western guys have gray hair too, but we just don't notice because it's not as obvious against brown hair or something.
Right.
But I was always like, why are these kids, why are there so many damn kids with gray hair? And eventually I kind of, I think it's because, I don't know, when you talk to kids who are preparing for Gaokao, it sucks up your life. I'm doing a story right now about twin brothers who, one of them is preparing for Gaokao and one of them is applying to school in the U.S., so kind of watching that divide. And you look, they go to school, they're like, either at school or in like a supervised study session from 8 a.m. to about 10 p.m., like every day, 6 days a week. And then they get like a half day off on Sunday, basically.
Well, thank God for that.
Yeah, just totally brutal. So the result of that is that when you get out of high school, when you get past Gaokao, if you've gotten into a college, I think of the kids as being in like a kind of a post-traumatic stress, you know, disorder state where they like get to college. And they just have had all the joy in study just completely beaten out of them. They want nothing to do with, like, academics that they're not interested in. And a lot of them just, it's like they, in college, they're very free in the sense that they don't have a lot of responsibilities. They could be doing whatever they want. They could get creative. They could form clubs. They could, you know. But if you've never had any free time until you're 18 years old, and then you're just, like, shoved, like, 10 hours a day of free time on you, you, like, don't know what to do with yourself. So a lot of them just end up on the video games.
Can't play the violin, like I just said in that example.
Yeah, just instant noodles and, like, video games. It's very sad, because I'm like, oh, man, you guys, like, you had such a rough go of it. So I understand, like, why you want to retreat into this thing, but, like, oh, what a burn, you know?
Yeah, totally understandable. But, wow, is that education system changing, do you think? Or do you think it will?
It's definitely changing. It's just going to be very slow. Like, there's you know, there's a reason why they stress so much before Gaokao. And there's a reason why the country runs on this Gaokao system. Like, they stress so much because, like you said, it's one-off. And because China just doesn't have that general kind of blanket sense of security. Where in the U.S., like, oh, like, I didn't get into, you know, Berkeley. Well, okay. Well, I could go to Santa Barbara. I go to Santa Cruz. Or
I go
to Cal State. You know, XYZ.
Or junior college. If none of those work.
Like, that's the thing. It's like, we have a very sort of the gradient going down. Our educational system is not super steep. It's like there's, you know, all along the way you can go to any college you want, and there's always second chances. You go if you go to junior college, you can always like transfer into a good college. Or even if you don't go to a good college, still, you get some good grades, you do some good internships, you come out, and you, like, the middle class life is still out there in front. Whereas with
China, still achievable.
Yeah, it's very achievable. Whereas here, the number of like really, really good colleges is very, very small. And then there's kind of like a huge drop after that. It's not like a, oh, you know, number one, two, three, four, and then it just kind of like fades downward. It's like there's Tsinghua, Peking University, Beida, Fudan. And then there are a lot of other good schools, but like after those three, it's just like a giant drop off. And a lot of people in major cities or people from good families, they really kind of have this belief that if you don't go to one of those three,
you're screwed. It's got to be Harvard or Yale, or you're nothing.
Yeah, obviously, you know, people have these attitudes in the U.S. too, but it's just much more defined here because there isn't this giant bulk like middle class that where you kind of just have the sense, yeah, it'll be okay, like everything will be fine.
You yeah,
just, you didn't get into the college, okay, it'll be fine. You didn't do that well on in your grades, it'll be fine. But there's just not this like blanket, it'll be fine.
Yeah, sure, and I guess the parents have extra motivation in China to have their kid or help their kids to succeed because the kids are going to be the ones supporting them, right? Like,
yeah,
it's a totally different culture than Americans.
The kids are most parents' retirement plan, and you know the parents aren't crazy in thinking like in thinking what they think.
It makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Yeah, like it's true. If you don't go to any college here, if you don't get into any college, and it's very, like, taking Gaokao doesn't mean you get to college. Like, you can take Gaokao and fail and go to work in a factory. My roommate took Gaokao, didn't pass the first time. She, like, did a whole extra year of school just to pass.
You can retake it?
You can retake it, but the next year. You have to take a whole other year. Repeat a year. Some people do that. It's not super common, but it's better than not going to college.
Sure. But then I guess you've got to like get a job or something the next year, right? Because you're not in high school anymore.
You can essentially go and redo your senior year.
You can do that.
So like, okay. You know, some people, they'll like, if they don't have a lot of money, maybe they take Gaokao in the city. But if they're going to repeat their senior year, they might go to the countryside where it's cheaper to live. Or if their family has money, they'll just send them to the same school. But yeah, it's not super common, but it's done. I mean, contrast that with SAT, where it's like, well, okay, you take it like whatever your like fall of junior year, and you could like take it again in the spring.
Yeah, wait 3 months.
It's once a year, one shot, and you know, basically your whole like 18 years of education is all building up to that one point. So
that is some intense pressure.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you've mentioned like a couple stories that you've written. So let's get into that. You work for the Huffington Post, right?
Yeah.
And how did you come to work for them?
So I got that job 2 years ago. It was after I'd been here in China for 3 years already, and I'd kind of just been slowly like working my way into journalism over the previous years. I came here right out of college in 2010. I taught English in Xi'an, a city in central China. I studied Chinese here in Beijing at a university. In my third year, I worked at a TV station, and I sort of started doing freelance journalism on the side. By freelance, I mean, like, I wrote things and gave them to people, and they didn't give me any money back, but I was okay with it because it was getting published.
So they got put online or something?
Yeah. So it started with some China blogs. Like, Beijing Cream was the first place that I published things, and then some China-focused blogs, and eventually moved from those blogs into some like real online publications. Then I sort of had, I was looking for a job. I had just strung together like barely enough, bylines, enough credits to my name that when the Huffington Post was looking for someone, I got connected to them. And,
The rest is history.
The rest is, yeah.
So did they just send you out on assignments, or do you have to pick things?
It's very self-driven from me over here because I'm the only correspondent they have here. I'm the first correspondent they have ever had here.
In Beijing or in all of China?
In all of China. Wow. So they never, before they always relied on the Associated Press and Reuters wires. You know, they'll buy the wires and they have the right to post those stories, but they didn't have their own correspondent here. And they sort of started a new venture, which is actually called the World Post. Like, technically, I'm the correspondent of the World Post, which is the Huffington Post World section. They partnered with a think tank called the Berggruen Institute. But, you know, so because they don't have an on-the-ground presence here, and my boss is in New York, and the bosses are really wonderful, but they don't have sort of they're not especially China knowledgeable. They don't have China experience.
Yeah.
So largely they count on me to come up with the story. Sometimes they'll say, hey, you know, we've noticed this thing is in the news. Can you find an angle on it? Or, you know, the climate talks are coming up. Can you find a China angle?
Sure, yeah.
So they'll do that. But other than that, it's usually I'll come up with an idea, I'll pitch it to them, and they'll say yes to this, no to that, yes to this, but, you know, twist it this way, shape it this way. And then we kind of come to agreement.
Okay. Would you? It seems like you travel a lot in China. Mm-hmm. Would you say you know the country pretty well at this point? I mean, geographically.
Geographically, I've been to a lot of places. There are places I haven't been. Like, I haven't been to northeast China except for like one city.
So, like Harbin area?
Yeah, Dongbei is the whole like blanket word for northeast, and I've been to Dalian, one city up there, but generally that region I haven't gone to. I haven't been to Tibet, but sort of central, sort of like the Chinese heartland, you know, the Chinese equivalent of the Midwest. I've been sort of all over there because I've been traveling even before I got this job. I've been moving around for the last 5 years.
5 years in China?
Yeah, that's what it's been.
It's a long time. Did you speak any Chinese before you came here?
I took 2 quarters at Stanford, where I went to undergrad, before I came. The first time I came to China was in 2008 for a summer job. Okay. And when I arrived, I really knew absolutely nothing. Just like Mao Zedong, Tiananmen.
Factories. That was the first word you learned, Mao Zedong.
Yeah, you know, like I just knew, like, even not even language, just China itself. I just had very, very limited knowledge. So on that trip, I just learned how to say, like, the numbers, 1 through 10, and I learned how to say I do not speak Chinese. But I just loved it. That was summer of 2008, and I just fell in love, and I decided
to come back. Right around the Olympics, then.
Yeah, right before the Olympics.
Okay.
And I decided I would come back in when I graduated. So I took 2 quarters of Chinese my senior year and arrived with like a, I want fish, you know, like that kind of level. Like, I am United States. I want this.
Yeah, check out.
So that was kind of how I arrived. And then
I remember learning how to say this and that, and then just point at it and say this, that, this.
That'll get you a pretty long
that
way.
Actually, you can do pretty well at that. And I know a fair amount of expats here. That's pretty much all they still know after being here a few years.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting how you can live in a culture and not speak the language at all.
You can get by.
But you, man, I've watched some of your Ultimate Frisbee videos. Damn, your Chinese is... I mean, I don't speak Chinese that well to know if you speak that well, but you really sound good.
I spend a lot of time. I realized/decided early on that I thought that learning the language was sort of my, like, top priority for understanding the country, being able to communicate with people, making my own life easier. And so I spent... You know, my first year, I was technically, my job was teaching English, but I was really basically just studying Chinese full-time on my own.
Okay.
Second year, was at a university studying full-time. Probably learned the most when my third year, I was living with my roommate, John Wen, who's Chinese from Shijiazhuang, and we would speak pretty much all Chinese at home, and I'd go to work at a TV station. I did a show about the Chinese economy, and the show was in English, but all the coworkers were Chinese, and so I basically got them to work with me in Chinese exclusively. So that sort of third year where I was working in Chinese all day and going home and speaking Chinese was the year that I think I really got it.
Year three, huh?
Yeah.
I hope it really turns on for me. I'll likely be here 3 years. It's been about a year and a half for me so far. I still think I'm a beginner, but hopefully push on to the next level.
It's the ultimate. It's very, very rewarding. That's all.
Like, I love studying it. It's so fun to study.
Yeah. It's nice because it never, as difficult as it is, it will give you exactly what you give it. Like, there's no shortcut. Nobody just, like, you know, just clicks and they're awesome at Chinese without trying. That's impossible. It's not like romance languages where you've got all these
cognates.
Yeah, you know, it's that just doesn't work. You need to just put in the work. But every hour, every, like, new vocabulary word, every sentence structure, every time you read a page, every time you have a conversation, it's all building. And, like, Chinese will give you back what you give to it.
Yeah, I mean, I speak Spanish pretty well, and although I just did a podcast in Spanish, actually, like,
wow,
recently, but Yeah, I mean, it came back pretty well, actually, but not thoroughly. The other two did most of the speaking, to be honest. But, yeah, learning Spanish, I remember I did a minor in college, and I studied in Mexico for a while, and just one day, the whole time I was like, God, I don't speak this stupid language, and like, I really want to learn it, and I'm trying and trying, and then one day I went, I speak Spanish. Like, I just remember it clicking one day.
That's great.
And it must have been building in my brain gradually the whole time,
yeah.
And then one day it was just there. It just seemed like it was just there.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was a gradual,
yeah.
Like every day learn a couple of words.
Yeah.
And suddenly you got the whole thing. I don't know. So you mentioned like living with someone who speaks Chinese and speaking Chinese at work.
Yeah.
So I think in general, learning a language, I think that's one important thing is really getting out there and speaking it.
Yeah.
Do you have any other tips for people?
For Chinese in particular?
Yeah, or Chinese in particular.
I guess I have a couple like theories which are based on nothing except my own experience. But one thing that I found was that that language immersion is really important. But I found that my learning process has been this kind of alternating periods where I'll have a period of intense study where I'll be like, say, whether it's in a classroom or even just studying on my own, where you're just like packing your head with vocabulary and sentence structures and, you know, you're just packing it all in. But like if you're truly studying full time, there's almost no way that you can, everything you pack in, you can be using in your daily life.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Like also, you know, when you're studying, you're not actually speaking all day. You're just like learning something and putting it in your brain. So I kind of believe that you have these periods where you pack everything in, and at that point, all the words, yeah, they're technically in your mind somewhere, but really your ability to use them is actually pretty low. You might be able to pass a test involving them, but your ability to use them is pretty low. And then when I'll do a period of that packing it in, and then I'll do a period of not actually studying anything new, but just using Chinese all the time. And then...
Oh, okay. You just go out and speak it then.
Yeah, and then I feel like in that period of time, like everything that I've packed in just kind of gets like aired out and spaced out, and I'll...
Yeah.
It's like relearning everything, because, yeah, I'll have learned a Chengyu, like these four-character idioms. I'll have learned it, you know, 6 months ago and have not said it in 6 months. And then in these periods of heavy usage, someone else will say it, and I'm like, oh, like, damn, I remember that thing. And then I'll find the next day I'll find a situation to use it. And so I think, you know, it's kind of like these periods of study is when you bring your potential level up higher. So you've elevated your Chinese potential, but you can't really fulfill that potential until you go out and have a period of heavy use, like the year when I'm living with my roommate studying.
Yeah.
And that year is where you actually sort of like fill in the space and you reach that potential. But if you're always doing the latter, if you're always just all about immersion and learning that way, eventually you'll hit your ceiling. You'll be like, okay, you will be able to say everything that you need to say in a daily environment as well as, you know, as well as you've learned it, and that'll be fine, but you'll stop progressing at that point. Then you need to go back to the classroom, or at least back to the study period, where you again stuff a bunch of new things, new patterns, new words, and you once again elevate your sort of potential level, but you're not really up there yet. Then you go back to usage and you kind of fill that up. That's how it's worked for me. Like my first year, I did a lot of packing in of words for a while, and then I had a period where, like, I packed in a bunch of words, but I didn't have a bunch of friends. And I sort of made a bunch of Chinese friends, and I used that period of time. I was like, oh, and then I sort of fleshed it out. Then I had sort of reached that level, came to Beijing, studied in a classroom for a year, packed in a bunch of words, and was still obviously using Chinese in my daily life, but wasn't really, like... wasn't using it 8 hours a day, like, nonstop.
Yeah.
So then after I packed in all those words, then I went to work at this TV station, lived with my roommate, and again, yeah, all the things I'd learned over the previous year just kind of, like, aired out, got rehashed, dug up, and really learned. And then I did it again. I went back to study at this Princeton in Beijing, like a 3-month summer intensive program. Again, pack all the words in, and then go out and fluff them out.
God, so about 3 or 4 iterations of that, and you're pretty solid.
I don't know if there's no science behind that, but that's how I've experienced it.
Well, I've never heard anyone like talk about it like that, and that's really interesting. That makes total sense. I've even had these little epiphanies here and there. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. I remember we were trying to get an Uber car once, and the guy on the phone said, like, "What's I Luko?" And I was like, "Luko, how do I know that word?" what is that? Oh, intersection! Oh, yeah, I know, yeah. I learned that before.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. You need, like, yeah, you'll say you know, if you're really full-time studying, maybe you study 15 new vocabulary words a day, but, like, can you possibly find a situation to use all 15
right.
words,
nah,
like, before you kind of forget them somewhere in your brain? No, like, you're going to put them in, and they'll be stored away,
yeah.
And you need to spend a while just, like...
Yeah, yeah, and that first time, like, digging it out, like, takes a while. And
yeah.
Then, but I found the same thing. After you use it a couple of times in a real situation, it just comes back.
Yeah.
Even if it's been away for a while. Huh, really interesting. What about the characters? Do you study those, too?
Yeah, I studied them all through my early years. Now it's gotten to the point where, because I'm not in a classroom, I'm not writing anything by hand anymore. So, I'm just doing everything on my phone. So
Like the rest of us.
Yeah, my writing ability has fallen probably pretty much off a cliff, you know, other than the basic stuff. But I can read.
You can recognize the characters pretty well?
Yeah, I can recognize and read and type, you know.
It's one thing I wonder about even Chinese people, if, like, they're losing, collectively, their ability to write characters.
I think it's not long for this world. I think in 20 years... Like, you know, currently people in mainland China here, they write simplified characters mm-hmm. that were simplified in, what, the 60s, I guess, under Mao. Whereas in Taiwan and Hong Kong, they use the traditional characters, which have way more brush strokes. And I think in another 20 years, and people in mainland China, yeah, they can kind of recognize the traditional characters, but they can't really write them themselves unless they've really studied it. And I think in 20 years' time... or maybe even less, maybe 15 years' time, that'll kind of be what traditional characters are now, where, yeah, you can read them and you can recognize them, you can use them, but the odds that everyone's going to be able to just, like, sit down and write them...
Ah, that's too bad.
Unless you literally have some job that puts you there with a pen and a paper.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not...
I've noticed, like, the older generation, especially when I just walk around, seems so much more interested in calligraphy than young people. I mean, I remember I was even... Where was I? In Hohhot, mm-hmm. Like a few months ago in Inner Mongolia. Mm-hmm. And I was walking through this park, and this dude had this, like, 6-foot-long piece of wood with a bulbous thing on the end. Mm-hmm. And it turned out he was painting calligraphy on the sidewalk using water. I mean,
yeah.
I think it was just filled with water anyway. And he was just working on these really, they looked complex characters with this giant paintbrush, essentially, but not using paint. It was just going to dry up and evaporate.
Yeah, somebody does that. Somebody does that outside my building, too.
Really?
In some parks here, yes. Usually they're not using, like, a giant thing. Oftentimes it's a, I don't know how big it is, I don't know, a couple feet long. But yeah, they'll just dip it in water. And yeah, it's very beautiful because they'll write the character. They're usually writing, like, a poem or something like that often. And
it's ethereal. It's like they're not doing this for money. They're not doing this for. It's just for their own enjoyment, I guess.
Yeah.
It's really cool to see.
Yeah, I like
but
that stuff.
I don't know. I've never seen a young person doing something like that.
Yeah.
So that just seems to be a dying art. And like you're just getting at with 20 years from now, what's it going to look like? And
yeah.
I mean, it's. I guess I hadn't thought about the language, the written language, being like you described because. It makes total sense. Like in English, obviously, we only have 26 letters. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to forget how to write a B. You know, I'm going to remember that forever, even if I never write another one. 50 years from now, I could come and write a B, but to write a Ma, like I mean,
I think people, you know, they're obviously going to continue teaching writing in school.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll be kind of like cursive, you know, like people in America, cursive is also a lot simpler than Chinese characters. But yeah, like if you had me sit down and write, you know, an essay in cursive right now, I could do it. I'd probably get it back with time. I think Chinese characters are going to be kind of like that, but a little bit more difficult because just factually, like how many times a day does somebody have to take out a pen and paper and write
an
essay?
I guess if they don't need it anymore and... If we don't need cursive, don't they like not even teach cursive anymore in schools?
Yes, might be. I don't know.
God, I mean, I learned it, but my handwriting's always been horrible. So
yeah.
I guess maybe that's why I appreciate it when other people have such good writing because mine sucks. It's just always been terrible. So let's talk about a couple of your stories that I've been reading let's go back to that Ultimate Frisbee thing that I mentioned. I guess I didn't mention, I know you through my girlfriend, Katie, who plays Ultimate Frisbee in Beijing on a team called Big Brother. And you've been doing like a series of videos, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Chinese.
Yeah.
And posting, is it just on Chinese social media?
Yeah. It's so what it is it's a plan I've had for a long time that I just finally started realizing this September. So I play Ultimate Frisbee. I played it since the high school, the beginning of college. I love it. And when I came here in 2010, I started, you know, there was already a good number of Ultimate teams here, but in the city I was in Xi'an, there was no Ultimate Frisbee. So I sort of taught some people, and we started the first team in Xi'an. And I've just really, you know, it sounds very silly. Everyone thinks that I'm, like, joking when I say this, but I'm absolutely not joking. Like, I've really seen Ultimate Frisbee completely transform the lives of so many Chinese people, young Chinese people.
Yeah?
And I just freaking love it. I love it so much.
That's cool to hear.
It's my favorite slice of China because, like, it goes back to all the stuff we were talking about earlier about high school life, Gaokao, and college.
Yeah.
And, you know, how much pressure are they under before they get out of high school? How little time for, like, free socializing? How little time for, like, boys and girls to be socializing, to do sports on their own? There's just, like, very, very, very little of that in high school. And they get to college, and it's like, you know, you think, oh, you're free, do all these great things, but they don't know how in some way. That's not in a, I don't mean that in a condescending way, but just, like, if you haven't had the opportunity to, like, sort of be socially self-driven, then it's hard to just kickstart it.
Mm.
And what I've seen is Ultimate Frisbee injects into people's lives at that point. Chinese Ultimate Frisbee a lot of times is rooted in colleges. And you'll see these kids join a team, and it has like the core elements of everything that I think that they've kind of been missing out on, and which I love, which I think is what life's about. It's about, you know, being part of a social group, being part of a team, which they haven't had a chance to yet. It's about playing sports, moving your body, sweating, you know, getting stronger, getting fitter. It's about, in China, Ultimate Frisbee is almost all co-ed, so it's boys and girls playing together. And the best part where it really all, like, comes together is the tournaments. Ultimate Frisbee is organized around tournaments, and here in China, it's usually say there will be a tournament in Dalian. Dalian, a city in the northeast. It means that all the teams, not all of them, but, you know, 15 teams from around China, everyone's going to jump on overnight trains, you know, take the train out. If they're college teams, they're probably broke and they're all sitting in like the hard seat section, like sleeping on each other.
Oh, those are brutal.
Yeah, they get out to the, you arrive there like Saturday morning, like super, you know, exhausted. They get out, they play games all day. And just the environment and the spirit of Ultimate Frisbee fundamentally is like goofy, silly. You want to play hard, but fundamentally it's a very friendly game. And then it culminates Saturday night in like a themed party. So all the players will get together. Usually in China, it's usually you have kind of like a food banquet. Every team has its own table, and then they just bring out crates and crates and crates of beer, and you go around pouring beer and toasting with every team and drinking games and costumes and getting silly. And I just, like, the first time I saw this was in 2010, my first few months in China. I went to a tournament in Wuhan. Completely opened my eyes to that. I just saw these kids, you know, 19 years old. They've never been, you know, they've never really traveled on their own. They've never been part of a team. They never had, like, boys and girls, you know, hanging out, playing sports.
Sure.
They've never gotten drunk. They've never, like, been to, like, a loud party with, you know, music. And, I went to this one in Wuhan. I just see these 19-year-old kids, their eyes as big as saucers, and they're just looking around. And, like, what I hear them saying with their expression is just, like, can I, like, have, like, as much fun as I want right now?
Is that allowed?
And I'm just like, yes, just everything, just do whatever, just get silly, get weird, dance, you know, get drunk, throw up, you know, whatever, just fucking do it. Like, I know
you've
been very sort of pent up for a long time, just go wild, you know. And I don't know, at that first one, it's like, yeah, everyone was going nuts, having so much fun. The Kazakh team, there's a team of Kazakh
from
players.
Kazakhstan,
they're Chinese, like ethnically Kazakh.
From Xinjiang?
Some are from Xinjiang, some are from different parts of the country,
okay,
but
yeah,
they call themselves Air Kazakh. And they just, like, at some point, they took over the speaker system, put on, like, the Kazakh tunes, and they came out doing these, like, you know, sort of, like, Kazakh, I don't know, I can't distinguish between Kazakh and Uyghur dancing, like, this sort of traditional, like, awesome, sort of leany, bendy Kazakh dancing, and just, like, ah, so much fun. So that's what I've seen, like, Ultimate do. And it's, you know, personally, my, like, close friends, it's really, it's transformed, like, the lives of a couple of my close friends in Xi'an. Kids who, yeah, they kind of come into college, and you just see them, they're just, their shoulders are hunched up, they're uptight, they're worried, they're nervous, they're embarrassed, they're not so, And you just see them with, like, Ultimate, with being part of a team, with being social, with getting silly, with getting drunk, all this good stuff. They just open up, and it really turns things around. So I always wanted to, you know, I always try to support this. I try to be part of it, help it grow. And the way that I'm doing that now is by putting out these series of videos where I'm teaching Ultimate Frisbee in Chinese. And I'm trying to do it in a really, you know, fun, funny kind of way. So I sort of, how many have I done so far? I think about 10. Each from about four or 5 minutes. I'm working with a production company here in Beijing called Xiaowen. Their app is called Xiaoshijie, Little World. And I sort of provide all the content. They help me film it and edit it. And so I try to make it a, you know, a fun, like, silly, goofy way to learn the sport and spread it.
That's really cool. I mean, I showed one of these to my cousin at home, who is really into Ultimate, and he thought it was pretty funny. I mean, he can't understand a word of Chinese. Yeah. I'll have to get a link out there to these. You can access them on the internet, right?
Yeah. They're on, like, Chinese video sites on this app, and I've put them on my own, like, personal YouTube account, too.
Oh, you have? Okay, yeah, cool. Yeah. We'll get a link out there for people to look at. And even if you don't speak Chinese, they're really funny. They're just put together really well, actually.
Yeah.
Good production.
Yeah, the company I'm working with there, you got really, like, good editors. You know, they slice it up real, and they got word, you know, like, font and words, like, flying all over the screen, keep it pretty, like...
It is pretty
it's
intense.
It's like it's on crack, yeah.
Yeah, but, I guess I've noticed, like, Chinese media tends to be like that a lot of the time, and repeating the same track, like music track, over and over and over.
Yeah.
Things that drive me insane. I don't know. I was on the train like a week ago, just for a couple hours, and this kid had this like game, and he kept playing the same like 10 second song over and over and over, and it was driving me insane. Yeah. And I looked around. No one else cared.
Yeah.
No one else was even aware that this kid is doing this. It's like, how can you guys do this? But I guess it's just one of those weird, different culture things.
I think people are just so used to being smashed together in very tight spaces that, like, you respond to that differently. I've never been to Japan, but from what I understand, like, sort of the Japanese response to, like, high density is to have everyone be, like, super polite and, you know, sort of maintaining a bit of a distance. And in China, the response is just, like, everybody do your thing, play your, you know, cell phone ringtone.
Be as loud as you want.
We'll just, like, all, like, sort of mutually agree that, like, we're not bothered by this stuff. And maybe if you grew up in that environment, you wouldn't be bothered.
I guess not. You've got that filter that can, you can still think even though that's all going on.
Yeah.
It's like, I complain about it, but I love it at the same time. I just love walking around here. It's just so intense. Everything, no matter where you go. There's just never a dull day living here. I just have to walk outside and something crazy is going to happen.
Yeah.
It's part of why I love it here. It's like so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess you'd probably feel the same.
Very much so.
And at the same time, it's like, I've been here, like I said, about a year and a half now. I kind of think I'm getting a hang of on how things work here and on the culture, but then I kind of realize I'm never going to understand certain things, or not on a deep level, or probably not. Obviously, I don't know, but I'm never going to be Chinese.
Yeah,
that's one thing you kind of have to accept.
Country is like it's an onion that you could just keep peeling back for
infinitely.
Yeah,
a fractal onion or something.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's been various points here where I'm like, okay, like I think I got it. Like I think I know what's up here. I think I know what these people are doing. I think I know what they're about. But it's like, duh. No. I look back on, like, the various, you know, kind of epiphanies and revelations, like, it's true, it was a worthwhile thought, it was a worthwhile discovery, but, man, there are layers.
Yeah, it is deep, and I guess that's all right that there's some things I guess I have to accept, I'll never know. It just kind of reminded me, though, I was, like, reading one of your articles. At the end of the article is the comment section always. I just wanted to bring this up briefly. There's always, usually at least, some incendiary comments. And some of them maybe are like, seem legit, but some of them seem like, this is some guy who's obviously never been to China. really has no idea what he's talking about. Do you even read these sections, or
I skip don't over them? Often read them, but sometimes it will. I guess just to me, like, the disheartening thing is that you realize that people aren't, like, reading something to learn something new.
That sucks. Yeah,
for me, the most common thing is if I ever write anything about pollution, it does not matter what the content is. If, like, pollution's getting better, pollution's getting worse, pollution is any commentary. It's just the comment section is just 100%, not 100%, a very high percentage about U.S. politics. The most common thing, every time I write something about pollution, it's the first, like, top comment is always going to be, this is what America will be like if the Republicans take the House next year. And I'm like...
it's okay, all about you man.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, I don't want them taking apart environmental regulations in the U.S., but that's not what I'm writing about here. Like,
yeah.
And it's, trust me, the U.S. is not going to look like China no matter what.
Yeah, I know, It's not even
in the same ballpark. And they're just, yeah, and then just, like, the whole comment section becomes this whole, like, back and forth about, like, U.S. politics. Like, okay, well.
Yeah,
thanks for reading.
I guess that's what they know is U.S. politics.
Yeah.
That's their life. But, yeah, that's another one. Like, the whole, like, well, Los Angeles is polluted, too. It's really bad. We have to do something about it. Well, okay, but come to China. You have no idea what pollution is.
I mean, yeah.
Until you come here, like, in November, December.
L.A. is an interesting... I've been reading a lot recently about L.A. as sort of a case study for cleaning up pollution, the same way that... like the Rust Belt in the U.S., Ohio, Michigan, places like that are kind of a case study for how do you sort of deindustrialize. Like, what can China learn from those places in terms of the economic transition, the social employment, you know, transition, and the environmental transition? So they are looking to those places, but it's just, you know, the scale is not...
Yeah,
not
that's one thing I thought... naively before coming to Beijing, like I knew I was going to be living in a suburb of Beijing, and that's where I was last year, and I thought, okay, well, I'll be out in the suburb, the pollution won't be quite so bad there, hopefully it'll be a little better, and by the way, if it ever gets really polluted, like on a weekend, I'll just take a train out to the next town and it'll be fine. I'll just, like, kind of chill out in this town where it's blue skies, like across the valley. And then I got on a train the first time. First of all, the suburb, if anything, was more polluted than downtown because some of the factories were out there. But then on top of that, I took a train for like a day, like literally 24 hours. And it was a good 18 hours before I could actually see blue sky. You know, I mean, obviously it was nighttime, less visibility. But it's like you leave Beijing and then you think, well, okay, now it's now it's going to be countryside, right? Not Tianjin, like... what, 10 million more people, and then the next city, and then the next city, and then the next city, and you almost have to, like, ride on trains or ride a bicycle or something around China to get an idea of what 1.5 billion people looks like in such a small area, city after city, and this, when it is bad in this section of China, it's just bad everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You can be standing on the Great Wall in the wilderness, and it's polluted. You stand in a cornfield 100 miles from here, and it's polluted.
Yeah, it's a North China thing, you know. And there are different parts of North China are polluted to different degrees, but this area that we're in is this Hebei, Beijing, Tianjin, Shandong. You know, this is kind of the epicenter. It's kind of ground zero, largely because this area is Hebei, which sort of hooks around Beijing, is the real, like, industrial steel heartland. So you at the very least have to get through that. But if you get out through that, if you're going west, then you get to Shanxi, which is a coal province, which is pretty dirty. Mm-hmm. If you get out of that, you get to the other Shanxi, and that's Xi'an. Maybe it's a little bit better, but yeah, you can ride. I often ride the high speed train between Beijing and Xi'an. It's like 4.5 hours on a high speed. And yeah, you can, pretty much that whole trip can be in pollution.
Yeah, just a constant fog. Although I will say, like, a week ago, I went up to Zhangjiakou.
Mm-hmm.
And have you been there?
I haven't been there, no.
Oh, okay. You basically just, almost the whole time, you're going through tunnels, through these mountains to the northwest of Beijing. Yeah. come out on the other side. It's not quite into Inner Mongolia yet. Mm-hmm. But apparently that's where a lot of the skiing events are going to be in the Winter Olympics in 2022. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of cool to see it. It was actually like a pleasant surprise. Much colder than Beijing, mm-hmm. for sure. It was like -1 or -2 Celsius in Beijing. Mm-hmm. Zhangjiakou was like -15, so like 0 Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. So very cold, but apparently the air there is pretty good usually. So that was good to see.
Yeah, you've got like, we have mountains to the northwest, I guess, and a lot of the pollution kind of runs up against that and stops.
Yeah, but that's the other thing. Besides all the industry you're talking about, like the mountains, there's a lot of factors here that are...
Well, it's very, very weather dependent. I mean, like you create the pollution, that's the baseline, and that's the problem. You know, we just stop creating the pollution. But how polluted is it going to be from day to day or from location to location is very much dependent on wind patterns and humidity and stuff.
Yeah, right now we're in winter, and it's difficult to walk outside when it's blowing, like when the wind is really strong and it's cold. That's tough, cold wind. But at the same time, I love it because it means the pollution is going to get blown out or is not there. Like today, we have a beautiful day today.
Yeah.
And that still happens.
Count your blessings.
Yeah. So one more thing I want to talk about before we wrap up. We were at a party a while ago, and you were talking about walking across Beijing.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to talk about like what that is and what your motivation for it was?
Sure.
Quick.
Yeah, I did this in in November, I guess, where I walked. Beijing is kind of built on this ring road system, so it's roads that form concentric circles going out, and it goes out currently to the 6th ring road. Sort of inside the 2nd ring is like the city center. 3rd ring is kind of a little bit wider. It goes out to the 6th. So I chose to walk from the east 5th ring road, which is like a little bit east of my house, good ways east of my house, to the west 5th ring road. So I think when I looked up the mileage, I think it was about like 24 miles or something like that, the route I took.
And that'd be the main bulk of Beijing.
Yeah, that's basically, you know, what we'd recognize as like Beijing, the city.
Yeah.
Outside of the 5th ring road, it starts to get pretty rural depending on where you are. But yeah, I did that. I've walked sort of across shorter distances of Beijing before. I remember my first year here after I'd spent a semester at school in the west of the city. And the whole semester I'd been coming across the city for Frisbee and friends. And I'd sort of get on the subway and ride it across the city, pop out on the other side and be like, oh, cool. You know, and I thought like, oh yeah, I get Beijing. And then one day when I finished my final exams the first quarter, I walked from there. So that was the 3rd ring road in the west to the 3rd ring road in the east. And it was just really cool to just kind of like, first off, to be above ground when I'm going across the city instead of in the subway.
Oh,
just
yeah,
to kind of like stitch together the various parts of the city that I thought. I was like, oh, here's, you know, Gulo. I know it as like an island, but like my mental map of the city, had been like these islands.
So
I wanted to do that again. I wanted to walk back across it as just, you know, something to do, get reacquainted with the city. So I walked, started like 8 o'clock in the morning, 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, in the far east side, east 5th ring road, and I walked across, and it took me about 12 hours. It was like a leisurely, you know, 12 hours. I took a long lunch break and a long
dinner break. To walk 25 miles, I guess.
Yeah, but it was great. I chose a day where it was frigid cold, but same thing. Yeah, the wind had blown, and the pollution was gone. It was a gorgeous day. I remember my favorite place in Beijing is like the dead center of the city is Jingshan Park. And you have a hill there where you can, if you go up on top of the hill, you kind of get a 360 of the city. And I remember just going up there and looking out at these same mountains in the west that we're looking out at. And I was like, man, I have never seen those mountains so clearly. You know, I've been here in Beijing for 4 years. I've seen the, you know, the silhouette, but I'd never seen the features so like perfectly etched. And so, it was a wonderful day, wonderful walk. And, you know, saw a lot, kind of felt like I got regrounded in the city.
That's cool, going neighborhood to neighborhood, the transitions.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Yeah, did you talk to a lot of people along the way, or was it more just about you and like this meditative
thing? Yeah, it was more meditative. I kind of I exchanged pleasantries with various folks, but it was kind of a me day, and I enjoyed it.
Well, that's cool. You ever want to do 6th to 6th? 6th ring to 6th ring?
I thought about that. I don't... Maybe in the summertime that would be possible. In the wintertime, that would be pretty damn difficult, given like the number of just like how sort of, you know, I was wearing like snow boots and like a big ass, you know, like a parka, the big kind thing. Of migrant worker army jacket, like a hat, okay. and stuff like that. Yeah. Maybe in the summer if you started it. 6 to 6, though, because each, as the ring roads go out, like the distance between them gets wider.
Yeah.
So I'd say going 6 to 6 would probably add like maybe 30% to the journey or something like
that. Yeah, if not more. Yeah.
So I could try. I wanted that. I did east to west. I was thinking about doing south to north.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That would be kind of fun. South of Beijing is an area that really is, people don't really go there. I don't really go there.
No, I've never been there.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot going on in the south, so it'd be interesting to walk that axis.
I mean, I remember, where I live, the neighborhood I live is Dongzhimen, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of expats here. It's a fairly like modern affluent neighborhood, and then there's another neighborhood near called Sanlitun, which is also mm-hmm. Expat central kind of, and that's on the east northeast side, I guess, of Beijing. I was just across to the southwestern part of Second Ring Road, and I was getting stared at like I would if I was in some rural place. And I was like, wow, you don't get stared at when you're in my neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, people are used to seeing foreigners.
Yeah, I think the South is, when I think about it, I've only gone there a handful of times in all my time here. It's just, I think it was sort of the last area to develop. Mm. So it hasn't really gone through what the rest of Beijing has gone through, which is like everything gets bulldozed and rebuilt, and it's, more modern. And as far as I understand, the South has been the last to go through that, or it hasn't really gone through that process, so it doesn't have the bar districts, the malls, the embassies, the stuff like that. So,
that might be interesting to do.
Yeah.
So, what's coming up for you in the future?
I'm getting ready for a move back to California, which is in March. Which at that point I will have been here for 5.5 years, and I'm going to move back and start doing. The goal is to try to work on China, California related stuff. I'm from California, and I got involved with this stuff because when I was waiting for my journalist visa here, I had to wait 8 months for my first journalist visa, and I spent it all back in California. So I spent a lot of time, fell in love with somebody in California.
So you have a long-distance relationship?
Long-distance relationship, it's a lifestyle.
Huh, that could be a whole another discussion, how to do that. It was other side of the world.
Yeah, so there's that element, and I also, I got excited about doing more stuff to connect my hometown or my home state and China, and I think, I'll continue doing journalism, I'll continue writing and stuff like that, but I also want to get my sort of, my actual hands on the levers instead of writing about other people's hands on the levers. So, that's going ahead. I don't know exactly how I'm going to do it, but I've got a book project in this area.
Writing the book?
Yeah, some other writing projects, and then whether it's, China-California connections are just growing very, very rapidly, and I think it's kind of, as I see it, it's kind of ground zero of the U.S.-China relationship is happening in California,
where
you've just got tons of Chinese students, tons of Chinese investment, a lot of research going on between the two places, government to government, immigration, birth tourism. It's a whole kind of cool, my favorite stuff is just cultural smash-ups, cultural blends, and a lot of it's going down in California, so that's the next. That's the next adventure.
Oh, that's cool. I don't know many people who have like the knowledge of China that you do. First of all, and then the language skills. I mean, all the stuff. So I'm sure all this will come in really handy.
Hopefully, yeah. I think a lot of people who go sort of deep on the China stuff, they go back and they think they've got to either be in like New York or D.C. That's our image of the U.S.-China relationship is that it goes down between Beijing and D.C. I'm trying to sort of like run an end around and say, you guys are missing the real shit. Let's go down in California.
So cool.
That's the goal. Sneak in through the back door.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to keep up on with each other, and I'll get a link out to your website. And well, let's see. Do you have a website?
I have a personal, it started as a blog that I was just sort of sporadically keeping, and I've sort of now just made it like a storehouse for my various projects. It's called An Optimist's Guide to China, and the URL is optimistschina.com. I sort of bank the work that I'm like most proud of. I put it on the website, and maybe I'll do more with it later on.
Okay, so we'll get a link for people to look at for that for now. And will Huffington Post, will you just search for your name?
Matt Sheehan, Huffington Post, S-H-E-E-H-A-N, if you search for that. Yeah, you'll find my work. You know, there's a lot of stuff up there. Optimist China is where I put that stuff that's actually worth reading.
But okay.
But, yeah, that's Matt Sheehan, Huffington Post gets you there, too.
Hey, sounds great. And one other thing I just thought of, you obviously know a lot about China, and you seem like really well-read. Can you recommend any books for people to read about China if they're interested in just learning about the culture and the history?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the sort of the ultimate trifecta, the holy grail, in my opinion, is three books by a guy named Peter Hessler. So it's Rivertown, Oracle Bones, and Country Driving, and I just feel that to me he's the gold standard of China writing, foreigners writing on China. He spent a lot of time here, and his books are very sort of slow and patient. They follow people over large time spans, over 5-10 year time spans, and I think that's where you can really, his powers of observation and his patience is really worthwhile. So starting with nowhere, from zero, I say Peter Hessler, get through those books. Maybe of the three, Rivertown, if you've just arrived in China, it's about his first couple of years here, so it's kind of got that expat experience stuff, which is great for sort of something to give you a picture of where the country is and what's going on in the country. Maybe the book Country Driving kind of gives you that whole experience. He talks about life in a village outside of Beijing, life in a factory town, and he follows the Great Wall all the way west.
Okay. So
those are, to me, he's the man, you know, and he's got more than a few people out here who agree with that sentiment.
Yeah, I've read Oracle Bones. That was a really good book. Yeah. I'll have to check out those other ones.
Yeah, he's the man, in my opinion. There's obviously a lot, lot
I'm
more
sure
to
there's
recommend.
Tons.
But
okay, so I'll check out those. Have you read Life and Death in Shanghai?
No.
It's about the Cultural Revolution, so okay. It's kind of a little older history. It's like 50 years old now. Wow, what a good book.
Important history.
Yeah, definitely. If you're interested in that particularly crazy period in Chinese history, that was it's a memoir, so it's. I'm sure there's a ton of them, but that's the one I've read, and I've really loved it.
Sounds good.
And I'll check out Peter Hessler, and I'll check out your future books that you're working on, your projects.
Yeah, they'll be out there, I hope.
Cool, man. Well, it's been great. Thanks for coming out here to talk to me.
Oh, it's been great.
Really appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For more information, you can visit my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. From there, you can sign up to get updates from this podcast delivered directly to your inbox. Remember, the Around the World podcast is all about meeting ordinary people who have done extraordinary things. Thanks for listening.